what's up? This is Rowdy Alternative. My name's Sam, and today we're here with a special guest, in my opinion, for sure. Mr. Bill Gibson, drummer of the famous band Huey Lewis and the News, and we're going to learn a lot about him today. How you doing, Bill?
I'm great, man. It's a little wet out here in California, but other than that, it's just fine.
Yeah, it's been raining here too. I actually just got off work not too long ago, and there was a big old hole in my bathroom ceiling with a bunch of water dropping out, but we're good. We're going to get that figured out. But yeah, man, so you've been keeping busy. What have you been up to nowadays?
Let's see. These days I am practicing a lot. I when the pandemic hit, I decided to start taking some lessons because I'm a self-taught player. And I always thought that I would regret it if I didn't take the time to figure out the math. You know, drumming's all math. You know, it's all subdivision mm-hmm. and stuff. So, and the technique and the math behind it. So that's what I did. I found a really great teacher. This guy, Henrique de Almeida, who was the chair of the drum department at Berklee College of Music for about 12 years. And I started doing online classes with him in 2020, and I haven't stopped. So we're off into some pretty crazy stuff now. But I'm having a ball. And I'm also playing with a band, a local band called the Sons of Champlin, which is led by Bill Champlin, who was a singer and keyboard player with Chicago for about 30 years. So.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. How'd you get in touch with them? I guess you knew him for
a
while.
Well, Bill and I went to the same high school here in Marin County. We went to Tam High together. And so I've known him since the late 60s, you know. So we've been friends for a long time.
That's awesome. I'm curious. I play drums too, and I love talking to other drummers, especially, you know, like you. And with the lessons you were talking about, and like, is it more of like a theory, like music theory or drum theory, or what?
No,
are some
well, I guess yeah,
that?
There's some theory involved. It's mostly technique.
Okay.
You know, the different techniques, the molar technique, finger technique. It's just all lots of different stuff. Right now we're into double bass drum stuff, you know, leading left foot, leading right foot, leading left hand with left foot, leading right hand with left foot. You know, there's so many combinations. So it's mostly technique, but it's also a lot of reading work, chart reading, and technique and subdivision and polyrhythms and all kinds of stuff.
Okay. Have you always read music, or when you like started out drumming, was it just by?
Well, I did. I played in my high school band, you know, my high school band and orchestra, concert band, where you had to read the music. So I do know how to somewhat, but not behind a kit. I mean, I couldn't today, I couldn't look at a chart and play it and go play it all. You know, I couldn't do that. I play by memory most of the time, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. What about the double bass? Is that something you toyed with in the past, or is that?
Yeah, I've used double bass for ages with the band Huey, and not that I use it a lot, but there are certain songs like "Couple Days Off" and stuff like that where it's all double bass drum.
Okay, awesome. Well, I want to get into some questions here, man. When you going way back, when I guess. Before or when you were with Huey or wherever you were at the time, how was where you were living at? What was the musical landscape looking like? It could be like locally, or it could be like what was what got you into it? What was the biggest, like the big thing at that moment in time? Or like what kind of music were you wanting to
well,
do?
Well, it was with pop music for me, first off, it was the Beach Boys. It was about 1962. I think I was probably about 10 years old. And my sister brought home a Beach Boys album, and I fell in love with it. In 63, the Beatles hit. So it was the British Invasion from that moment on. And then I was living in Mill Valley California, which is right across the bridge from San Francisco. And of course, the San Francisco music scene was just exploding at that point. So I was going to the Fillmore, but from the time I was 15, I was going to the Fillmore pretty much every weekend and seeing everybody who came through, you know, Hendrix, The Cream, Traffic, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, The Dead, The Airplane, all the local San Francisco bands. So I was just, I was immersed in it. You know, it was all happening right here in Marin at that time. So you couldn't avoid it.
Wow. Because like you hear about that area and you have like during like, even after the British invasion, you had like the Summer of Love, which was huge, and like San Francisco and all that. And so I hear, and so like when, and you probably get asked this a million times, and I personally don't know how it happened, but when did you first meet up with Huey and the rest of your guys in the band?
Huey and I were in junior high school together. I was in seventh grade. He was in eighth grade. We didn't really know each other, but we knew of each other. And he went off to Lawrenceville Academy in New Jersey for high school, and I stayed in Marin and went to Tamalpais High. He came back and started playing in a local band. I was in a local band with Johnny Cola, Huey's original sax player, and Mario Cipollina, our original bass player. We all three of us were in a band together. And our keyboard player, Sean, and Huey were in another band called Clover. We were doing the same club circuit here in the Bay Area. So that's how we met and became friends, really. I knew Sean from high school. But Huey, we met, it was probably right in the, 1970, where we became real good friends. And then we, from then, and then it just, you know, we became so close that when those two bands broke up, we decided to form a band of all our favorite musicians. And it just happened to be five of us from those two bands.
Okay, nice. And reading up on you and looking into what your past work and what you all were into and everything, were you into jazz? Were you like a big jazz guy?
Yeah, I was raised on big band jazz. My father was an architect by trade, but a frustrated jazz drummer. And he gave me my first pair of sticks, and he taught me how to swing. And, so he was really influential. There was music in my house always. My mom was a choir director of our local church. She'd have choir practice in the living room, and she'd play the piano, and she'd do choir practice. My dad would come home from work and put on Buddy Rich or Count Basie or Ellington or, Woody Herman, all that stuff. There was music going on all the time. So my parents were a huge influence. And they really kind of got me into it, which was rare at the time. You know, most kids would tell you that their parents were saying, yeah, you're going to play rock over my dead body.
For sure. What is it, in your opinion? Because like when I think of like the different styles of drumming, like obviously you got rock, blues, whatever, but jazz is a world of its own, at least in my opinion. What is it, in your opinion, that makes it like that? That makes it like this? It's kind of like I look at it as like a mountain that you have to climb until you could actually say you're good at it. Like,
it's impeccable musicianship. And that's mm-hmm. That's what attracted me. I think the players are just so good. You know, they're the best on their instruments in the world. So I think it's really the musicianship, the level of musicianship.
Yeah. Right. When you got into playing music in the bands you were in, was it easy or difficult to kind of switch into like a more rock centric style?
No, not at all. It was easier because I've been playing along to all those records ever since I got my first drum set. You know, I'd play along to jazz mm-hmm. records too, but I was playing to Chicago albums, to Hendrix albums, to Cream albums. You know, I was playing along to any of the big albums of the day, Beatles records, Stones records. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was playing rock more so probably than jazz at that point.
Right. And that is funny. Like Chicago, you said Chicago and Hendrix, like that has a ton of, for the drum standpoint, there's a ton of jazz like influence there for sure.
You bet. Yeah. Mitch Mitchell was a monster.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember hearing a Fire for the first time. And like, I tried to play it. Like, is he a human? Like, how's this possible?
Yeah. That was one of the ones that I learned note for note when it first came out. I love that song. That's one of my favorite Hendrix tunes. And I learned that one note for note. I could play that for you right now, but exactly like the record.
Awesome. You remember what kind of kit you had when you first started?
Yeah, I had a Ludwig Super Classic. My father got it for me in 1965, bought it for me for Christmas. How old was I? I just turned 14. And I said, hey, I need a drum set. And him being a drummer, he went out and he said, yeah, actually, really, he sandbagged me big time. He said, no, I'm sorry. It's just not in the cards this year. We just can't afford it. And I came out on Christmas morning and there was a brand new Silver Sparkle Ludwig Super Classic, top of the line with zildjian cymbals. And, hit me to Zildjian. He said, these are the best. Don't ever get anything else. And so I've endorsed Zildjian for over 40 years now.
So the Ludwig Sparkle, is that the one that kind of Ringo played?
Exactly.
Super nice. That's awesome.
Well, Ringo played a black onyx or black marine pearl is what they called it. And I actually have one of those kits. But, it's the Ludwig 65 Super Classic, which was their top of the line kit at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, man, for sure. How would you describe the style when you played with the News? You still do, but when the News was like popping off and everything, was it, cause like I listened to it and I've listened to it growing up, like all my life. And it's, you could call it a rock band, obviously at bare bones, whatever. It's a rock band, but there's pop elements. I don't want to say new wave, but I guess it's like, cause it came out, it was like the 80s, right? So it kind of had that too. How would you describe it?
I would describe the first album as kind of new wave / pop, because the tunes had pop sensibilities. You know, they had a verse and a good hook and, they were pop tunes, but they were played at breakneck speed, which kind of made it new wave-ish, with a lot of the guitar stuff, gang, 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 you know, that stuff.
Yeah.
Which was real, which was really part of the new wave scene. So I would say pop new wave for the first album. Then everything after that, except for the R&B, the cover albums we did, was really kind of pop / R&B. I've always been a huge James Brown, Ray Charles, R&B guy. You know, I've always loved great R&B, Motown, Stax, Muscle Shoals, always loved all of that stuff. So there's a lot of influence, and all the guys in the band have those same influences as well. So I think there's, it's R&B infused pop.
Yeah, and you could hear that too. If you really like, even just with like the rhythm section, there's like funk elements, kind of like it's so tight. And I hope this question makes sense, but when I think of you guys, like it's just a tight band. Like you listen to it, and like you listen to the Stones, and sometimes like even Zeppelin, like they're sloppy sometimes, but that's what makes that them. But with you guys, like, was it always like that? Like, how'd you guys gel since the beginning?
Yeah, well, we just played hours and hours and hours a day together. And like, even before the News and before my other band Soundhole that I told you about with Johnny and Mario, we just would go after school. We'd go after school and play for hours. That's all we did. And by doing that, we learned how to improvise together. We learned how to kind of, and this was with Mario playing bass, and he and I got so tight that we knew what the other guy was going to do. We instinctively, you know, so that just made things all the tighter, all that much tighter. And I think just the hours and hours and hours put into playing, and then when the news got together, it was the same thing. We just played all day, and we were so familiar with the other guys playing that we knew what was going to happen.
Right. And I'm also always curious to know in a band setting when it's less than just like one artist, like a James Brown or a whoever, when it's a band setting, how was the writing process, whether it be the music aspect or the lyrical aspect? Was it a group effort? How'd you guys usually hash that out?
Well, since Huey had to sing the words, and he was a good wordsmith, he typically wrote the lyrics. You know, there were times when we'd get together and he'd throw out lyric ideas, and we'd all sit around and try and come up with something that might work with it, what he's doing. But typically he would write the words and the band would write the music. Like somebody would come up with a musical idea, we'd bring it into practice, and we'd demo them up on our little home studios and come in and play the music. And Huey, I think that'll work with my lyric. Or, you know, and if it didn't, then maybe he'd write another lyric for it. But it was always the band, and we would get together in rehearsal and work out the arrangement and the parts. And so everybody, it was a very democratic process. Everybody had their two cents worth of opinion, you know, about the arrangements and what the parts should be. So, it was always real democratic with us.
So it was always pretty smooth then when you like say, hey, we're going to write a song today. And like, was it usually pretty smooth process?
Pretty
then?
Smooth.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure.
there were days when it wasn't smooth at all, you know, of course. But for the most part, yeah.
Yeah, you'll
early
have
on for the most part, man, we were the main writers in the band, Chris and Johnny, were just coming up with stuff all the time, you know. They were very prolific. And there was a number of years where that happened. So there was no shortage of material. And even I had a lot of stuff going on back then. And, I've written 5 or 6 or 7 tunes for the band that worked. And I've written a lot of other stuff that just wouldn't work for our band, you know. But, it's pretty smooth for the most part.
Yeah. During your guys' era, I guess at your peak, that was like around the time when MTV really became popular. And that's another thing I've been thinking about a lot lately is like, obviously MTV was a huge part of the music industry. Was that for you guys? Do you credit some of that to be like success towards your guys' band with like the music videos or like a significant part in addition to your music being good, but like with like MTV?
Oh,
rising?
Yeah, there's no question. We were one of the first bands on MTV and that was huge for our success. Huge. I can't give it enough credit. You know, you had to have the singles, you had to have the songs on the radio, but when the video thing came in, you know, we were really good at making those videos because we did them without being too serious. You know, we always tried to keep our tongue firmly implanted in our cheeks so that, you know, we never took ourselves too seriously. And I think that came across really well in the videos and it endeared us to an awful lot of people. So yeah, I think MTV had a huge, huge part of our success.
Yeah. I remember one of the first music videos period that I've ever seen. I want to say was If This Is It, which is when you were on the beach, I think. Yeah. Were there any that you look back on and think like, man, that was a blast to film? Or like, were there any like memories you have from that? Like any music?
Yeah.
Videos?
Most of them were super tedious because there was, there was so much just sitting around and waiting, you know, for the people to get the set right, for you to step in and lip sync for 2 minutes, you know. But some of it was really fun. Like the video we did for Doing It All for My Baby, where we're Huey's Frankenstein and he's Dr. Frankenstein. Yeah. Then he turns into Frankenstein and Sean is the hunchback and I have no hair and a big funky nose. And, you know, Mario and I are the two-headed guy, you know, all that. Yeah. Was, although it took hours to get ready to do that, you know, and that took about 4 days, and every day we'd have to go into this prosthetic makeup thing early in the morning, which took hours. It took like 3 or 4 hours. Mm-hmm. And then we were ready. So we'd walk around the rest of the day with all that makeup on. And it was really fun. That was a really fun one to do. In my recollection, most of them were really tedious because there was just so much sitting around and waiting, you know?
Yeah. So like you got, and that's what I always wondered. You brought it up there about music videos. Like, you literally just lip sync. Do you play anything at all? Do they blare it over a speaker? Like, does that work?
They just roar it over a speaker and that was it. You know, you just play along to it.
Yeah. Awesome. And a thing that I just learned about you is that you were at the We Are the World session. How was that experience, man? That blew me away. Like, that had to have been like top tier.
Yeah, top five in my career for sure. I mean, you know, we walked into that room and you just look around and you go, oh, look, there's Ray Charles, you know, oh, Michael Jackson, oh, yeah, Stevie Wonder, yeah. Oh, look, Harry Belafonte's standing right in the back of me. Oh, yeah, there's Daryl Hall. Yeah, oh, Springsteen's over there, you know. Oh, hey, Diana Ross, right? Yeah, I mean, for anybody, even for them, it was daunting, you know, even for the huge stars. They were, I don't know if you saw the documentary, but somebody, I think it was Lionel Richie, described it as everyone in that room felt timid, you know, and you're talking about the biggest stars in the world, you know, and everybody, there was a certain timidity that everyone felt because it was just overwhelming, man. The talent in that room was, you know, you won't find that again.
No. And I did see that documentary and I was, and they were talking about how it was like that. It was everyone was real, like, kind of on edge. And I think, was there a lot of ego in that room? There had to have been some.
Well, Quincy put a sign over the door that on the way into the studio that said, "Leave your ego at the door," right? Which that's most right, people right. did. You know, there was a little break in the session. We were all on the way in. We were all given sheet music, and there was a little break. And during that break, we all went around the room and got everybody else to sign it, the sheet music, right? Which I have it in my office. And so, you know, everybody was really cool, but there was a couple of people, I won't name them because it's nice to do it, you know, but there was a couple of people who were too important to sign. Let's put it that way.
Oh man. Yeah. I guess you'll have that.
But I mean, most everybody was very cool and signed the sheet music, you know, it's really cool. Had people asking me. I had huge stars asking me for my autograph.
Yeah, that had to have been crazy. Were you there? Because I forget exactly how long that session lasted, but I want to say it was like 12 hours or something?
It started at about 11:30 at night after the Grammys or the American Music Awards.
I think it was
the AMAs. It started after that. We all showed up at A&M Studios at about 11 o'clock, I think it was. The session started at 11:30. I left that session at 8 o'clock in the morning the next morning, and I hear it wrapped up about 8:30 or 9.
Okay. Yeah, that was what I was going to ask. I didn't know if you stayed the whole time because, like, you know, you're doing your different parts.
Most of it.
Yeah. That's crazy. When I also read that you guys were the only, like, was it like the full band there? Because, how'd that feel? Like, that had to have been like, wow.
Yeah. That was very cool. And the reason why that was, we were the only full band invited. And the reason was that because that was Quincy's idea. Quincy wanted the whole band there. because he knew we could sing. He'd seen us do our a cappella bit, and that we incorporated into every show we did. And so he knew that the band sang, and that's what he wanted. He wanted singers. So he invited the whole band.
Yeah.
And that was, wow. You know, we were honored to be there.
Yeah. And Dan Aykroyd showed up for some reason.
Yeah. Dan, I know Dan a little bit. He was standing right in back of me in the choir. And at one point I turned around and we were talking to him and he said, "What the F am I doing here?" He's just looking at all the singers, you know. But the Blues Brothers were a big thing then, you know. So
I figured that had to have been it.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I also saw, well, first I want to ask you, the Huey Lewis in the News, like, entity right now is on hold, right? Because Huey had his hearing trouble, I believe. Is it like right now just kind of on hold, or do you have anything like cooking up?
There are lots of stuff going. We have a play that's opening on Broadway on April 19th called The Heart of Rock and Roll that we're very excited about. It's a fictional story, and the story is, it's not about the band. It's a fictional story that is tied together. The storyline is tied together by our songs. So, and it's all our music. That's really nice. I saw it in San Diego. They ran it in San Diego in 2019 just to see, you know, if there was potential for it, and it was really good. So they decided to do it, and they've got a theater, James Earl Jones Theater. It premieres on August 22nd. The big gala is, April 22nd. And the big gala is April 19th. And that's when we'll be there. So, we're looking forward to that. We also have some albums that we're planning to release over the next few years, some live stuff that we're going to release. And we're going to probably re-release our first album. We're going to remix it.
Okay.
And re-release it.
Awesome. I can't wait for that. What do you, with the play, Heart of Rock and Roll? I wrote it down. I think that's
called The Heart of Rock and Roll. Yeah.
Yeah. What input do you have with that? Is like musical direction?
Huey has producer's credits in it. He's been there the whole time, overseeing the musical end of it. And, you know, they've had to rewrite some of the words a little bit in some of the songs to make more sense for the storyline. So he was a part of that. The band has had really no input other than these are the songs that we wrote, you know, but as far as tweaking them for the show, where the band's had no input.
Okay. Awesome. Well, that's exciting though, regardless. And, when you have your off time, or like even when you guys were playing and touring and in between tours or whatever, did you ever do like your own side projects? Like, did you cut drum tracks for other bands, or did you have your own stuff going on too?
I did a few sessions here and there, not a lot. I played on a couple of Chris Isaac albums. I played on my friend Alex Call's album. Alex was a member of Clover with Huey. And Alex wrote Jenny, 8675309 for Tommy Two Tone.
Yep.
And he wrote A Little Too Little for Pat Benatar. He's written, and he wrote Perfect World for us as well. So I played on his album, sang on his album. But usually now, not a lot of stuff. And I'd go sit in with friends. Chris Hayes, our guitar player, and I had a little side kind of fusion band that we did a few gigs with and recorded some tunes, but nothing ever really came of it. So it was just for fun.
Yeah. Do you find it interesting nowadays how, like you were talking about, like when you guys are when I asked about the writing process earlier, when you guys were all like, you know, brainstorming together and like, I assume like in the same room, same studio. And nowadays all you got to do is record it, shoot it on your phone to someone. Like, how do you view the progression of not just music, but like the recording style nowadays? Do you think it's more convenient? Do you think it's difficult? Like, how do you do that?
I think it's more difficult in the sense that there's a learning curve that's huge, as opposed to just going in and laying things down to tape, which is what most of our recording was in the early days. It was all to, you know, 24 track tape. Nowadays it's all Pro Tools or whatever DAW you're using,
yeah.
But the learning curve for all that is huge. You know, you got to know how to run a computer. You got to know the program. I use Pro Tools. This is my little studio at home, and I use Pro Tools, and the learning curve, I mean, I'm still learning it. I've been using it for 10 years, and it's just very difficult. I haven't scratched the surface really of what it can do. It's extremely powerful. So I think it's, in that sense, it's more difficult. It's in the sense that you can manipulate what you've recorded. It's unbelievable what you can do now. You know, we used to, sometimes when we, like, say we're doing background vocals to tape, we'd cut one chorus, and if it was going to be the same thing in the next chorus or the next couple of choruses, we could make a two-track mix of those vocals and then fly them into tape, which means you'd have to hit record on the 24 track, and when the moment came, you'd hit go on the two-track, and it'd lock sync up, and then you'd record the two-track onto the tracks of the 24 track for background vocals. And, you know, it was hit and miss. It might be off by 50 milliseconds, and so it'd be late. So you'd have to go back and do it again and hit that button just right. You know, it was crazy. Now with Pro Tools, it's cut and paste. It's the easiest thing in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, that's like every take you have to do. And like every time, like hit or miss, like, that's money, right? Like, that's just money you're spending. And so it's probably a lot, and time. It's probably a lot cheaper and more time-saving to do Pro Tools.
Yeah. And it's a lot cheaper. All the stuff today is a lot cheaper.
Yeah. And even, like, when you guys were, like, and I might have the years wrong here, but, like, in, like, the 80s, I think, like, it really started to kick up, or like the electronic beats and stuff, like drum machines, stuff like that. Is how do you work as a drummer? If say someone wants to put that kind of stuff in the song, how do you work alongside that, like with the electronic part versus you actually being a human being?
I just use it as a click track. I use the machine as a click track because that's basically all it is, right? I mean, and you play along to it. We used machines on a lot of our stuff. You know, in like on the sports album, Bad is Bad, that's a Lindrum. I programmed a Lindrum. Johnny came up with the arrangement, and I programmed the machine, and that was that. Like, I Want a New Drug is a Lindrum, kick drum, and snare drum. I went in and overdubbed hi-hat, another snare drum, tom-toms, and real cymbals. So it sounds like a real drum set, but it's not. It's a hybrid drum set between real drums and machine. And we experimented with that stuff early on.
Right. And that's just something that I could never wrap my mind around how that works. It just seems like a daunting task to really sync that up with and get the sound you want. Because you want this certain sound, and you have so many moving, like, cogs that you need to match up to get it.
Well, with the Lindrum, you only had one bass drum tone. You know, there was just that one tone. You didn't have a ton of samples yet. Some other machines were about, like, that was about, well, when we were using the Lindrum on that, I think the samples were maybe another year or two away. was you could really interchange different mm-hmm. tones that you were looking for. But on a Lindrum, it was just one bass drum sound. And you could tune it to make it, you know, lower or higher pitched, which was editing the sample, I suppose. But it was just one sample. And you know, and like I said, I just used it as a click track. It kept things real solid.
Yeah. As time went on with you guys, and obviously every band progresses and they do different types of, you know, style, different types of, they venture into other subgenres. Was there ever a certain kind of music you wanted to play that you might never have gotten to, or that you did play that you look back on thinking like, wow, that was a lot of fun?
With the band or me personally?
Either.
Well, now I'm kind of getting more into kind of outside stuff, polyrhythmical, odd time signatures. And I've always been intrigued with guys who play that stuff well, you know, like Vinny Colaiuta, mm-hmm. who's just seamless in with polyrhythms and different time signatures and stuff. I admire that stuff a lot. So I'm dabbling in that now. I'll never get to his level, but you know, I'm attempting to do some of that now. It intrigues me.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's the beauty of the drums, because like you could literally do anything with it.
Big band jazz. I'd like to do some big band jazz. So.
Right. And you, who are some drummers that you look at like in the jazz area? Like, you know, I think obviously like Buddy Rich, guys like that, but like, are there any like more under the radar guys or guys that never got their due credit that you look back on and think like, man, that guy was badass?
Well, I think they, among drummers, these guys probably got their dues. Sonny Payne, Count Basie's drummer. Mm. Rufus Jones, another one of Count Basie's drummers. They kind of interswitched between Duke Ellington and Count Basie's bands. Philly Joe Jones, Billy Cobham, mm-hmm. Chester Thompson was a great player. Terry Bozzio, who I went to school with. Terry was he's not underrated, I don't think, but not a lot of people know. Drummers know about him.
Yeah.
But the general public doesn't know much about him, I don't think. You know, Dennis Chambers, Dave Weckl, Vinny, mm-hmm. Tony Williams.
Yeah.
Tony Williams. Well, you know, all time.
Yeah. And like, it is funny how jazz works, because it's like, it's a huge genre, but it still feels like it's a niche, like kind of, you know, like there's not a lot of people who are fans of it, but there really are.
Yeah. Yeah. I know what you mean.
What about any, you got any like for like upcoming drummers? Like I know some guys like Corey Coverstone, he played in Dirty Honey, a upcoming rock band. And he's real big into the jazz stuff and everything. And he's learning it too. And he's trying to master it. Is there any advice, and not only with the jazz drum and just in general, that you would give to these guys coming up who like might be still getting the hang of it and trying to get into the swing of things?
Practice with intention. Mm-hmm. Practice doesn't make perfect. Practice makes permanent. So what that means is you could be practicing something, but if you're not practicing it right and you don't have the right intention with it, you're going to ingrain it into your head the wrong way, you know? So practice with intention. I hope that makes sense.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I'm looking back on my stuff. I'm like, man, maybe I need to practice with intention more instead of just going wild on the kid.
Well, yeah, because it'll ingrain a lot of bad habits.
Yeah, for sure. What about I look at, like one of my favorite drummers, I love Keith Moon, but like he, I feel like would only be right for The Who, because he's almost the lead instrument in that band. That's the way I look at it. But like, obviously, if you're a drummer, your main goal, 99% of the time, unless you're Keith Moon, is you're keeping time. You're not overpowering the other instruments. Is there like a method to that, or is there, you have a certain view on that? Like, don't go crazy on the fills or easy on the cymbals.
Yeah. Well, when you're playing in a group with that has a lead singer, you know, it's about the song. It's about the lyrics, really. The music obviously is support of all that, but you're not going to want to be, you know, you're not going to want to be filling every other bar when the guy's up front trying to sing a song. You know, it just wouldn't work. However, that said, guy like Keith Moon with a three-piece band kind of had to do that. Yeah. Same with Mitch Mitchell. You know, they're very busy players. And it just worked in situations like that. I was fortunate enough to see The Who with Keith Moon a few times. And
oh, really?
Yeah. And I don't think that he would have ever been successful in any other group. You know, it was just for some reason, it just worked. And he was really lucky that it did, you know, because he was not all that solid. He was pretty loose and loosey-goosey, and, you know, there was really no rhyme or reason to his fills. It was just kind of just go, you know. Yeah. That wouldn't make it in very many bands. I tell this story. I don't know who the drummer was, but I went to see John Legend play. This was maybe about 10 or 15 years ago. I went to see John Legend play, and he plays tunes that he sings, and it's piano driven, melodic, nice changes. But the drummer ruined that show for me because he just wouldn't settle down. He couldn't play a four bar stretch without filling. And I mean, he'd start a fill a bar and a half too early, in my opinion, and it just ruined the show. So you can be, there's such a thing as being too busy, especially in a band where you're backing up a singer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's funny. Cause unfortunately I wasn't able to see Taylor Hawkins, but I, looking back at like the Foo Fighters, like with he was in the band, I felt like that's a cool example, because he was like ferocious back there, but he still managed to not be the lead instrument, but like at the same time, like you could always hear him. You could always, you know, that's Taylor Hawkins. And like, I feel it's cool that some,
well, if
like-
you listen to him, and I knew Taylor, I met him a few times. I hung out with him a few times. And first time I met him, it was funny. I took my daughters. I have two daughters, and I took them to see the Foo Fighters over at the Oakland Coliseum. And I talked my way backstage. I knew one of the security dudes. I said, man, let's go back and meet these guys. I like them. You know, they're cool. So, and my kids are looking at me. Really? We're going to go back and meet? Yeah, come on. Let's go back and meet them. So I took them back, and I walked into the green room, and there was Taylor sitting on the couch talking to someone. I just walked over to him, and I introduced myself. I said, hey, hi, Taylor. My name's Bill Gibson. I'm Huey Lewis from the News Drummer. And he looks at me. He says, no way. I said, yeah. I said, yeah. And he says to me, dude, I grew up playing to your albums. So, you know, and then I met, and then we hung out again in Japan once. But he was a sweet kid and a great player. And if you listen to him with the Foo Fighters, he's rock solid, man. That music, you know, it screams for the open hi-hat. You know, and the wide open cymbals. Yeah, that's the kind of music it is. Mm-hmm. But his fills were well thought out. You know, all his stuff was really well thought out. And he wasn't just filling for the sake of filling. He had a purpose. And you know, he was a great timekeeper, Taylor was. So he was solid as a rock, I think, that guy was.
Yeah, and like I look at him and guys like a lot in really like the pop punk stuff, like there's punk, but like especially the pop punk genre, like guys like Travis Barker, guys like that, they have that they could keep time excellent, but they also have so much stamina and so much, like, they just rip into it. And I don't know, like, that just seems crazy to me how you could balance all that. You know what I mean? And without losing another element to it. Like, it just seems so crazy.
Yeah.
To do.
Well, you know, you got to pick your spots too. You can't do that. You can't do that all night. Cause you know, you're gonna, you're not going to be able to do it. Believe me. You can't play a 2-hour Foo Fighter set if you're filling the entire night. It was funny.
Right.
We were in Osaka one night. We had a night off and the Foos were in town. So our whole band went down and Huey actually got up and jammed with them. And, we went to their show and we were sitting around and I was on the side of the stage there and it came time for Taylor's solo and he starts soloing and, their keyboard player, Rami, comes over to me and he says, Taylor's showing off for you now, you know, cause he says he's doing an extra long solo. He's showing off for you. So I said, well, cool, you know, let him go. And I could tell he was wearing out. He went for like probably 8 minutes, 9 minutes.
Oh,
and he definitely wore himself out. I could tell he was huffing and puffing by the end of it. And you know, you just can't do that. You have to pick your spots for stuff like that. And if you're playing in a group like that.
Right. Did you ever do any of those solos at like the live shows? Were you ever big into that?
Yeah,
kind of stuff?
I did early on, but, it was never, there was no 8 or 9 minute solos. It was usually just a couple of minutes because, you know, it wasn't about drum. Our band was never about showing off the drummer.
Right. Yeah. It just,
and I was never, to be honest with you, I don't think I was ever a great soloist. And, you know, I'm more of an ensemble player. Nowadays, I'm probably 50 times better soloist than I was when we were touring, just by virtue of the fact that I've been practicing so much and learning all these new concepts. So, I mean, I'm a far better drummer today than I was when we were touring. In my opinion.
Well, yeah, no. And like name of the game here, I guess moral of the story is like you said, practice, practice, practice. And when you get the time to do it, practice your instrument.
Yep.
Well, Bill, thanks a lot, man. Like, this is awesome. Great talking to you. I appreciate it. Thanks for the music, all you guys. Like, really, like, it's transcended generations. I grew up listening to it just like my mom did.
Well, you have great musical taste, Sam.
Thanks a lot. If you have any plugs or any want to say what's going on, you're talking about the play and everything, but if there's anything you got going on, the floor is
yours.
But
just people can keep their eyes out for in the next couple of years for some live releases and our first album release again. The play is a big one for us. If you make it to New York, go see it.
Yeah. Yep.
Where are you?
Yep. I'm actually in Cincinnati.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, but I'm always key. I want to say that, like, you guys came here all the time. I could be wrong. I feel like I always heard that, yeah, Huey Lewis is in town.
We played so. Riverbend countless times. And we played a club there called Bogart's. I don't know if it's still there.
Yeah, I was just there a month ago.
Yeah, we played there in our early days. So,
wow.
Yeah, we've played Cincinnati quite a bit.
Nice. Well, thanks again, Bill. I appreciate it. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And check out Bill's stuff he has going on. Huey Lewis in the news, of course.
Sons of Champlin, too.
Also,
the Sons of Champlin.
Oh, yeah. The band you're in with what was
Bill Champlin.
Again? That's right. Check them out too for sure. I know I will be. Also check out Rowdy Alternative on and Raise Rowdy, the websites. We're on social medias, everything. You'll find us there. And thanks everyone for listening. We'll see you next time.